I really am grateful, and I'm sure that you are as well, for the great messages that we had this morning. And as Pastor Bob and Pastor Mark shared from the book of Nehemiah, I was really encouraged, and I had to go and kind of rewrite much of my message after the fact, because Mark, you gave me this perfect setup to go into the passage in chapter 4, and so I gotta move along with that. And as Mark was sharing this morning, you may remember that he was talking about how in the passage there, in those verses of chapter 4 from verse 10 through 15, that Nehemiah brings up four different groups of people, or four people that are being, or who are speaking in that passage. First were those of Judah, and then we have the word of the adversaries, and then we have the word of the Jews. And he gave just a really good overview of what they were saying and what the heart, the motive behind their words was. And now we're coming to the passage where we have Nehemiah's response to everything that was going on. If you open your Bibles to Nehemiah chapter 4, and you look there at verse 13, and you notice that the very first word in verse 13 is the word therefore. And because the word therefore is there, if you've been around Calvary Chapel for any length of time, then you know that we always want to talk about what the therefore is there for. And we've got to go back and we've got to put some context to it and understand a little bit of what has happened before, even though it's still probably fresh in our minds, going through some of it last night and much of it this morning. I think it's good to backtrack just a little bit. And there are some things in chapters 2 and 3 and 4 that really stuck out to me as Mark and Bob were sharing this morning. And some other things that I was seeing as I was reading through the passage that I wanted to hit on and just kind of lead into this section to give some context to the therefore and what is taking place in chapter 4. The first thing that is really beautiful and stands out to me in chapter 2, if you back up just a little bit, is the fact that Nehemiah, after the 5 months of prayer, and as he is now doing his job, the work that he did day to day, standing before the king as a cupbearer to the king, when the opportunity came, when the door opened and the king speaks those words to him, "What would you like me to do? And why are you sad in my presence? I've never seen you like this before." But the thing that is just wonderful about that is that when the door opened, Nehemiah was ready with a plan. He knew exactly what it was that he would want if that opportunity came. He knew that he had a very providential position, being the cupbearer to the king at that point in time. I mean, just amazing providence of God, how everything would fit together so perfectly. And then I believe it was Bob this morning that also highlighted and pointed out the connection to Daniel's prophecy. I mean, it was not happenstance that Nehemiah was where he was at that moment in time in the months of November and December in 444 BC. When the brothers came from Jerusalem and shared with him, and then the 5 months of lead up to that point, the work that God was doing in his heart, preparing him for that opportunity in 445 BC to say to the king that I want to go back to Jerusalem and see the city restored to what it once was. I mean, all the things that God was doing behind the scenes in the midst of that. But when that opportunity came, Nehemiah was ready with a plan. He knew exactly what he wanted. And that plan, it came from those 5 months of prayer. And I think it's so important for all of us in our lives personally as followers of Jesus, but then also in whatever positions of leadership that God grants to us in the kingdom, that it is in those places and in those times of prayer before the Lord that we really are able to develop the plan that we would be able to accomplish, a vision. And really, that's what Nehemiah had. He had a vision from God. And it's pretty amazing to consider that the city had sat in ruins for so long, although the temple was built because of the work that God had done through Ezra, still the ruins and the rubble of the city were great. And it seems, I could be wrong, but it seems like through that entire period of time, no one thought to say, you know, we should try and rebuild the wall before we try to rebuild the city. And there was the vision that God gave to Nehemiah during those months and months of prayers. He knew exactly what it was that needed to be done. And so he knew that the wall needed to be built. He had a plan. He did not have the permission of the king. He didn't have the resources that he needed. He didn't have the people to accomplish the vision, but he had the plan. And I know for myself, in serving the Lord and following him for almost 20 years now, and I've seen it not just in my life, but the lives of other people around me, people that I look up to, people that are peers with me, people that I've been able to kind of be a Paul in their life. As I look at them, so many times that's the way it works, that we have a vision and we have a plan, but we have zero permission, we have zero resources, we have no idea how it's all going to come together, but God is developing in us a vision and a plan during those times of prayer. And so he had this God-given vision and plan that came through persistent prayer. And then there was that moment where the door opened. And as soon as the door opened, he offers this just short little prayer. We can only imagine, speculate, what his prayer was in that instance when the king said, "What would you like me to do?" He didn't have a lot of time, but he'd already been in 5 months of persistent prayer. So then it was just the final thing. "Well, Lord, here we go. Open the heart of the king as I give him this request." And immediately the king granted his request. He gives him permission. He gives him resources. He didn't give him an army to do the work. He didn't give him all the people to do the work. He still had to share that vision with other people. But Nehemiah instantly had the permission and he had the resources that he would need. And then he sets out on this journey, as we've already seen going through the book of Nehemiah. And as he's preparing to get to the city of Jerusalem, it took quite some time to get there. It's quite a distance. If you go directly from Babylon to Jerusalem on a straight line, it's 800 miles. But if you go follow the Fertile Crescent, it's 1,000 miles. And this is on foot or at best on the back of a camel or maybe a donkey. But it's a long period of time to go that distance. And so finally, when he gets there, then he's given the opportunity to pull together a group of people. And ultimately, as we saw this morning, when he shares the vision, and he shares that he's been given permission, he's been given resources, he shares the vision with the people, and ultimately he has a group of people that God gives to him. And I can't help but be thinking in that context of what Jesus said to his disciples in Matthew's Gospel chapter 9, when Jesus looked at the task that he knew, this is the heart of God. He looks at the task that he's wanting to accomplish in this world. He sees the multitudes and he's moved with compassion because they are sheep without a shepherd. And he says to his disciples, "Pray the Lord of the harvest that he'll send forth laborers into the harvest." And so you have to know that during those 5 months that Nehemiah was praying for resources from the king and for permission from the king, he was praying for laborers. And in that instance, when the need was given, then they had all the people that they would need for that work. And Bob did such a good job this morning in chapter 3 talking about God's answer to that request for the laborers. And it's interesting, and he pointed this out, and honestly, I hadn't thought of this, and I hadn't seen it before when I was looking through chapter 3, but he brought out this just really important truth. It was not the kind of people that you would say, "Those are my wall builders. Those are the guys that I'm going to want." I mean, he mentioned the perfumers. You know, this isn't exactly the group of people to lead the construction of the walls of Jerusalem. And yet those were the kind of people that God brings together. And it's a good reminder to us that we don't always have the kind of workers that we might expect. We don't always have the kind of laborers that we might think that we need in that instance. But God knows what he needs. And he knew that they were the kind of people that had the mind and the heart to work. So they would not have been probably the people we would select, the people that we say, "Okay, those are our wall builders." But if you think about it, they were the right kind of people. Because if Nehemiah had real wall builders, it would have taken them a lot longer than 52 days to finish the wall. You see, I think sometimes God selects the unlikely people, the people who don't have any idea, any clue, because they're the ones who can run into the work in faith and jump right into it, and they don't have all the ifs, ands, or buts to say, "Oh, we can't quite do it that way." These guys and gals were just a whole bunch of people that had no idea what it was to build a wall. So to them, building the wall, you go, "All right, fine, I can do that." And they were able to accomplish the work in much faster time than they probably would have been able to do it if it were real wall builders. So God knows what he's doing. And sometimes the people that are brought to us, we might look at them at the front end and say, I can't possibly use this kind of person. But reminded of God's word to Samuel when he sends him to go to anoint the new king after King Saul, and he looks at all the sons of Jesse and he keeps going, oh, this has got to be the guy. And God says, no, it's not him. No, it's not him. No, it's not him. And finally, God gives that great word that God does not see as man sees. Man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. And God could see that this group of people who ultimately were the workers in Nehemiah chapter 3 that brought about the work to rebuild the wall, they were the kind of people that God wanted. They did not look on the outside like wall builders, but inside they had a heart and they had a mind to work. Additionally, what comes out in chapter 3 is that there were many different small groups of people. I think there's at least 40 or 41 different groups that are mentioned in chapter 3 that are doing the work of building the wall. So there's all these small, diverse groups that are brought together for one task. There's a diverse crowd, but they had a unity of focus. And in that, we see this important truth that God does not need the giant army to accomplish his big tasks. A lot of times he just needs a small group of people that are dedicated to the work that's right in front of them. When you read through chapter 3, it talks about these people doing the work right in front of their house. They walked right outside of their house and they built the portion of wall that was right there. And so it was a small group of people faithfully doing the work that was right in front of them to do. And, you know, I know, even though I come from a church that's a moderately sized church, you know, we have, I don't know, 500-600 adults that gather together and call Cross Connection Church their home church, but it's nowhere near as big as some of the churches in my area. I mean, just down the street from us is one of the largest churches in the United States, got 11,000 people at their church. And it's very easy as a leader, as a pastor, to look at the bigger ministry down the road, especially when you're a small church in Sweden or in Denmark, and maybe you've got 50, 70 people that are part of the church, and it's easy to go, if I just had those thousands of people like those mega churches in America, think of the amazing things that we could do. And yet so many times in the scriptures, we see how God selects a small group. And he can save with many or he can save with few. And we think of the story of Gideon, how God whittles down the army of Gideon to where it's just 300 people that when you probably looked at them, I'm sure Gideon looked at the army that God left him with and Gideon thought, we're going to die. I'm absolutely certain that's what he thought. And yet with 300 men, they put to flight, the book of Judges tells us, put to flight 150,000 Midianites. So God is able to save with many or with few. And we think of the fact that Jesus selected 12, and ultimately only 11 of those that he selected ended up being the apostles that he would send forth. And God added to the number Saul of Tarsus, who became Paul. But when you think about it, through this small group, God turned the world upside down. And so when we look at, to us, what might be very small and insignificant and feeble, And all those things might be very true, as we've already considered in the book of Nehemiah. We need to remember that God ultimately is the one who is able to accomplish the work. And it's his work, and he's going to do it. And the best way for him to get glory is when he uses perfumers to build a wall that's still standing, as was pointed out today. I mean, he truly gets the glory for that as we look at it. And so God is able to do amazing things with a small group of people who are faithful to the work that's right in front of them. I think it's absolutely amazing, even in my own country that's known for these massive, they don't even call them mega churches anymore, they call them giga churches because they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And yet even in my own nation, do you realize that the average church in the United States of America is still 75 people? So we think of big, and yet the work that God is doing in so many ways is so much smaller, and it's focused in a specific area to a specific people and for such a time as this. And so we see that in the book of Nehemiah in such a wonderful way. And it's important for each small group to realize that you just may be a church, but you're a part of the church. So you might feel like, well, we just don't have very much, but you're a part of something far bigger than you might realize. And so make sure that you don't miss that you're a part of the church. Of course, that brings us to chapter 4. And as Mark shared this morning, in chapter 4, we see as God is working that the enemy takes notice. And you can always be certain that when God is working, the enemy will take notice. But one of the things that becomes really clear as we go through chapter 5 and as we get into, or chapter 4 tonight and get into chapter 5 and 6, is that I think that we often give the enemy way too much credit. Because as we see everything play out in chapter 4 and we see that their threats don't ultimately materialize to much, I think it's really important that we understand that the enemy who opposes us is not all-seeing. He is not all-knowing, and he is not all-powerful. And I think we need to be reminded of this quite frequently, because we can sometimes fall into a pattern of thinking where we think that the enemy who opposes us is the equal opposite of God, and he's not. He's not all-seeing. He's not all-powerful. He's not all-knowing. But the God who we serve is all-knowing, all-seeing, all-powerful, all-good, all-loving, and he's on our side. And so, as it has been said before, one with God is a majority. And we need to be reminded of that. We need to remind ourselves of that. And we see that truth surface so many times throughout the scriptures because we need to be reminded of it constantly. And when the people of God failed, it was when they got their eyes off the Lord, as Mark was sharing this morning, and when they got their eyes on their circumstance, when they got their eyes on themselves, when they got their eyes on something other than the Lord, that's when they begin to fail. I can't help but think of Numbers chapter 13, where the children of Israel were preparing the first time to go into the promised land before their 38 years of wilderness wanderings, and they send in the 12 spies. And when the 12 spies return, 10 of the spies give this report that discourages the heart of the people. And they say to the people all true things. They say to them, the land is a good land. The land is flowing with milk and honey. It's a fruitful land. And there are giants in the land. All of that was true. But then they kind of processed all of that truth through the lens of themselves. And they said, and we were as in our own eyes like grasshoppers before these giants. And in our own eyes, we will always seem way too small for the task that is set before us. There were only two of those spies, Joshua and Caleb, who said, yes, all that's true, but those giants will be bread for us. Why? Because God is with us. Sadly, if you've read through the story before, you know that the children of Israel did not hear the report of the two spies so much as they did of the 10 spies. And so they went with the majority report, and we were as in our own eyes like grasshoppers before them. And so the enemy always opposes the work that God is doing. So you can know that if you meet opposition, it's a very good indication that you're in the right place, because the enemy opposes the work of God. And as we read through chapter 4, as Mark was sharing this morning, they built in the face of opposition. I'm reminded of Paul's words when he was writing to the church at Corinth, and he's telling them that he's not going to be able to come and visit them because a great and effectual door has been opened to him, and there are many adversaries. For some reason, we seem to think that a wide open door means that it's easy sailing. But that's not what Paul reveals there in 1 Corinthians. A great and effectual door has been opened to me, and there are many adversaries, much opposition. And we see that throughout the scriptures as we see it here in this passage. So the opposition from the enemy, that means that God is at work. And if you're experiencing that opposition, then you're probably in a good place. Pastor Mark showed us this morning that the enemy has one singular purpose, such a good point. And that singular purpose is to remove our eyes from the Lord, and to focus our eyes on ourselves, and to focus our eyes on our trouble, and to focus our eyes on our circumstances. And every single one of us have been discouraged at some point in our life because we were looking at ourselves or our resources or the task and thinking we can't possibly accomplish this on our own. The enemy gets our focus on our feebleness. As Mark said, he gets our focus on the greatness of the task at hand. He misrepresents our motives. He questions our ability to finish the task. He seeks to undermine our perseverance. He intends to discourage, and he aims at creating confusion. And he's been doing it for a very long time, and he's quite good at it. And so we've got to always keep our eyes fixed upon the Lord. And so when we get to verses 10 through 15 here in chapter 4, which is the focus of our study tonight, it seems that the discouragement of the enemy has had a pretty solid effect. they've been able to bring about a discouragement among the people. But it's important to understand the context in which verse 10 happens. Look at verse 9, Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 9. We read this morning. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God, and because of them, we set watch against them day and night. The work of God is both spiritual, we made our prayer to God, and it's physical. We set a watch against them day and night. Really important to recognize that the work that God has called to us is both physical and spiritual. And because it is both physical and spiritual, the work of God is spiritually and physically taxing. Now, every single one of us have jobs that we do, work that we do, whether it's work around the house, it's work in the yard, it's work for a corporation, it's work for a church, whatever it may be, the physical demands of life can be challenging, and they can make us tired and make us look for an opportunity to rest. But the added component of the work of God is that it's not only physical work, it's also spiritual work. And since it's both physical and spiritual, then it taxes us at both a physical and spiritual level. And this is not something that's only for, you know, human beings. I mean, look, Jesus was fully God and fully man. And if you read the Gospels, you see that he experienced physical and spiritual taxation like we do. And even he was tired, and even he needed to go away and rest a while, because the work that God has called us to is physically and spiritually taxing. So the result of all this, we read it in Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 10. Then Judah said, this is the first group, Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall. I wish that I could say rubbish the way that Mark does. His accent is just, it's the right way to say rubbish. I can't say it. I'm American. So, and our adversaries said, second group, verse 11, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So it was, verse 12, that the Jews, third group, who dwelt near them, came, that they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Listen, if you feel that your strength is failing because the work is hard, it's a reality. There are times when our strength fails in this hard work. It is a hard work. It is physically demanding, and it's spiritually demanding. And so they were not just building a wall. You see it here in the text. We saw it there in verse 9. They were building the wall, but now, because they have the opposition of the enemy, they're also setting a watch against them day and night. So they're building the wall all day long in an arid, dry, hot land. And at the same time that they're building the wall, they're setting a watch, a 24-hour-a-day watch. They've got quite a task going on. And they're trying to do all of this while they're navigating the trash, the rubble, the ruins of the previous city that was broken down by the Babylonians a hundred years before this whole situation. And the whole situation created a strategic nightmare. So it's hard for us to imagine it, but here they are in the midst of all of these buildings and walls and everything that had been cast down, and now it's just been sitting there for a long time, and it's like this giant trash heap, and they're trying to build a wall in the middle of this, and it creates a strategic nightmare because there's no real easy way to see where the enemy might come against them, and now they have this fear that the enemy is going to come against them. And all of this rubble and rubbish, it creates the perfect cover for an attack. If the attackers wanted to come, no one could see them coming. And so when we read in this passage that the strength of the laborers is failing, it makes perfect sense. They're working 24 hours a day. They're trying to build the wall during the day. They're trying to keep watch at night. They're kind of trying to watch their back the entire time that they're building the wall that's right in front of their house. And so they are fearful and they're tired. And there's all this rubbish, and they're not able to build the wall. And in the midst of this, the adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come in the midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So the conditions were perfect for an attack. And the adversaries see that this is an opportune time. They're vulnerable. There's no way that they can guard against the attack that we're going to bring against them. And so as a result, the Jews dwelt near the camp. Really important to consider what this says in verse 12. The Jews that dwelt near them, dwelt closest to the front lines. That's what it means. Those people that are closest to where the enemy is, they're crying out to Nehemiah. 10 times they tell him and say, listen, we're in a really vulnerable position. This is not going to work out. We need to do something about this. This is the reality of ministry. This is the reality of serving God. That we have the physical demands of serving God. You know, I have a great privilege to be able to be a pastor full-time working at a church. But to be very honest with you, when you're a pastor full-time working at church, what it means is you have a job like most other people. You have a lot of just daily tasks throughout the week. You have the joy of those things being done for the Lord, on behalf of the Lord, and being able to minister to God's people and preach and teach the word. But there's a lot of meetings throughout the week. There's a lot of just general tasks throughout the week. And so just the physical demands are tiring like any other job. But the ministry, the work that God has called all of us to, is also spiritually demanding, as we see in this passage. And there's always the real possibility of a spiritual attack. And so here were these people committed to the work that God had called them to. They're rebuilding God's city around the temple of the Lord. And there is the real threat of an attack. And so those at the closest point of the front lines, they come to Nehemiah time after time after time. 10 times, it might seem like, man, oh man, or do we have to hear it another time? But the threat was looming. And oftentimes, the stress of a looming attack is greater than the actual attack. And we all know this to a certain extent. Have you ever had anything in your life that you've been worried about and you stress about and you're anxious about and you spend days, perhaps weeks, stressing about this thing, and then when it actually happens, it turns out it was nowhere near as bad as you thought it was going to be? Anybody ever experienced that? I think we all experienced that at some point or another. You know, just about 2 months ago, our older daughter, she's 8 years old, one morning she was eating her breakfast cereal, I think it was it, and she chipped a tooth. And Addison, she's a wonderful girl, but she's given to being anxious. It's a real weight upon her mom and me because this little 8-year-old gets anxious about things. So she chips her tooth, and she doesn't want to tell us that she's chipped her tooth because she's afraid she's going to have to go to the dentist and have a shot. And for an 8-year-old, having a shot is like the worst possible thing in the world. Well, sure enough, she finally tells her mom. She wouldn't tell me because she was convinced that if she told me, I was going to immediately take her on a Saturday morning to the dentist and fix it, like right then. So she finally tells her mom. We talk to the dentist. We send them a picture on the phone, and he says, you're going to need to come in. So we go in. I believe it was the following Monday. This happened on a Saturday. And she is just a mess, tears streaming down her face at the dentist because she's scared to death of getting a shot. And so I'm sitting right next to her at the dentist, and the dentist is sitting there, and he says, listen, Addison, I just need to look at your tooth. And he's got his light on his forehead, and he goes, but I need you to close your eyes because my light, it's going to hurt your eyes. So she closes her eyes. He gives her a shot. She didn't even know that he gave her like 4 shots while her eyes were closed. And she opens her eyes and she goes, am I going to have a shot now? Tears streaming down her face. I said, you already had the shot. And she goes, no, that's not possible. It was not that big of a deal, but she spent probably 72 hours scared to death of the shot and just worried about this thing. And it's just the exact same way that we are. 10 times or 100 times, we go back to the thought in our minds and we just cause ourselves to be fearful. And in reality, when you see what ultimately comes about from Sanballat and Tobiah and all these different guys, ultimately their threats are worthless. And there's coming a day when we shall see the enemy for who he really is. And we are going to say, as the prophets say, this is it. This is the one who scared the nations. And we're going to realize who he is in reality. He is not all-seeing. He is not all-powerful. He is not all-knowing. But our God is. And so we need to be reminded of this. We're reminded of Jesus to not worry about our life. Matthew chapter 6 in the Sermon on the Mount, verse 25. In verse 27, he says, which of you by worrying can add a cubit to his stature? You can't make yourself any taller by worrying, that's for sure. In fact, those who worry oftentimes are hunched over and much shorter than they should be. The command is given by Paul in Philippians chapter 4, be anxious for nothing. And we break that command constantly. But I'm so grateful. God always gives us the algorithm, if you will. He gives us the way in which we can fulfill his commands. So in that passage, he says, be anxious for nothing. And then he says, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. And that's what we need. as God's peace to guard our hearts. Well, an imminent potential attack was there. They were fearful because they were in a very vulnerable position. They are not able to see because of all the trash that's built up, and they're at the lower levels building up this wall. It's about half its height at this point, so they're in this position where they're absolutely convinced that they're going to be overtaken. That's the backstory. That's everything before the therefore. That's what the therefore is there for. So Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 13, therefore, look at Nehemiah's response. Four things that he does here. Therefore, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked, and I arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, to the rest of the people, do not be afraid. Remember the Lord great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. So Nehemiah here does four important things for us to take note of. First, he says, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall. Nehemiah placed armed guards behind the lowest, most vulnerable, exposed areas where they were doing the work. Right where the workers were at the front lines, where they were afraid that someone was going to come and attack them, and they had no one who had their back. They're focused on what they're doing right there, and they're vulnerable, and they're at a weak place. And so Nehemiah sets right next to them, he positions right with them at the most vulnerable position, armed guards. And this is instructive to us in our own lives, that we need to make sure that we have assessed our own lives to see what are our vulnerable positions. What are the exposed areas of our own lives, of the defenses of who we are? Every single one of us have weak positions in our lives where we are open to the attack of the enemy. And those are the vulnerable spots where we need to make sure that we have taken up the full armor of God. You know, we like to, as it's said in the United States, accentuate the positive, which means we like to put all the lights on the parts of our lives that are the strongest. But in reality, we need to shine light in the areas of our lives that's the weakest so that we can be ready for when the enemy comes. And he will always come. And I have found, and I'm sure that you will identify with this, that the attack of the enemy comes most apparently when I am tired, when I am hungry, or when I am sick. And that's when I'm most vulnerable. And so when I'm in those places, I know that I'm most exposed to the work of the enemy. And here we have the most exposed area. And so Nehemiah positioned armed guards in the most exposed areas. And not only did he position men behind the lower parts of the wall, but it says, I set people according to their families with their swords and their spears and their bows. Another English translation, the King James Version says, and on the higher places. So we have the lower part, the vulnerable part, that he positions armed guards. But on the higher places, I even set the people after their families with their swords and their spears and their bows. So he has two lines of defense. One right there at the front line where the people are doing the work, but he's also set an overwatch position. And these are the guys with the bows. They're ready, the archers that are watching to see if anyone's going to come and try to attack. Notice that he says that it was families with their swords and their spears and their bows. This was family members defending one another. So wise of him to do this, that he engaged the family members of those who were doing the work in this overwatch position. Wise because who's going to love them more than their families? Who's going to be more intent to watch them than their families? Who's not going to get distracted by something else like their iPhone in the midst of all this? It's going to be the families. And there's a very good instruction here. We need to make sure that we reach out to our families, those who love us the most, and say, would you watch over us in prayer? And so he says, I positioned those behind the lower parts of the wall. I set people according to their families on the overwatch position. Verse 14, I looked. Again, another English translation says, I looked over the situation myself. Nehemiah didn't send someone else to look into these things. He looked into it himself. He went to make sure that those people were right there at the front lines defending them, right, having their backs. He made sure that they were in the overwatch positions. He took personally the concerns of the people that were coming to him concerned over these things, and he addressed it himself. And after he looked into these things himself, it says, "And I arose and I said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, and your wives, and your houses." I arose and I said, the fourth thing that he did. Notice to whom Nehemiah spoke. He did not speak to the enemy. The enemy was bringing their threats against them. He didn't go to try and set up some sort of diplomatic solution with the enemy. You cannot barter with the devil. He spoke to the leaders, the elders, and to the people, and he encouraged them. He spoke to their specific concerns that they had. And what did he say? He said, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight." All the concerns that were shared with Nehemiah were true. They were exposed. They were vulnerable. They were tired. They were working 24 hours a day. They could not handle this attack on their own. Everything that was being told to him was absolutely true. But in the hierarchy of truth, it was a lower truth than this important truth that stood much higher, and that is God was with them. So he says, remember the Lord. We need to understand that there is a hierarchy of truth. There are things that are true about you and I, but they rank lower on the truth pole, if you will, than other truths. Things like what? You're a sinner. You are weak. You are foolish. You are, you know, totally incapable of yourself to handle this work that God has called you to. Every single one of those is true. But it is also true that you are forgiven, and God has saved you, and God loves you, and God is strong, and God is wise, and God is on our side. Those in the hierarchy of truth are higher truths, which means we should focus more on that. So all of this was true. They were exposed. They were weak. They were in a terrible situation. They were not fit to the task that God had called them to. But they had a God who was on their side, who was greater than all the things that they were focused upon. And so he says, do not be afraid. Remember the Lord and fight. Remember the Lord and fight. One of the things that I love in Nehemiah that shows up repeatedly, especially here in the fourth chapter, I think it shows up four times in the fourth chapter, is that the truth that it's not God's sovereignty alone, nor is it man's hard work and responsibility alone, but it is these things together. God is fully sovereign, and God has given us a task to do, to be responsible for. Look at it in this passage. Look at verse 4. Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 4. We see God's sovereignty. "Hear, O God, for we are despised." So they're calling out to the sovereign God. And then in verse 6, we see man's responsibility. "So we built the wall." They called out to God, who is sovereign and powerful and good, and they got to the work of doing the building of the wall. Then at verse 9, "Nevertheless, we made our prayer to God," the sovereignty of God. In the same verse, man's responsibility. "Because of them, we set a watch day and night." You see, they didn't just assume, okay, we've prayed to the sovereign God, we don't have to do anything. Nor did they assume, well, we can't reach out to God because he can't do anything, so we've got to do everything. They prayed to God and they set a watch. Then in verse 14, "Remember the Lord, great and awesome." The second part of verse 14, "and fight." Remember, God is great and awesome, and you have a fight to wage, a war to step into, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Listen, for the last 500 years, we've had this continuing debate within the body of Christ after the Reformation about, is it God's sovereignty or is it man's hard work and responsibility? And the fact is, in the Bible, we see both of these things together constantly. God is sovereign, and he has sovereignly given us a work to do. We're responsible for that. One of my favorite passages of scripture is found in Philippians chapter 2. It says in verse 12, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." That's your responsibility. "For it is God who works in you, both to willing to do his good pleasure." That's his sovereignty. And so we see this come back over and over. And when we understand that God works sovereignly as we work heartily, then look at this, verse 15, Nehemiah chapter 4. And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us, their plot, and that God had brought their plot to nothing. It happened that all of us returned to the wall and everyone to his work. Nobody stayed home saying, I can't go because I'm fearful. Nobody said, I can't be a part of this work because I might get assaulted and destroyed and my family's going to be killed. Everyone went back to the work. Why? Because the enemy found out that he was exposed. And the enemy loves darkness and he flees the light. And so when he's been exposed, he can't do anything. They'd run away. And so it was, verse 16, from that time on, that half of my servants, says Nehemiah, worked at construction while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore the armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Everybody was there. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other hand they held a weapon. Every one of the builders, had his sword girded at his side as he built. And the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. And then I said to the nobles, to the rulers, and to the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on the wall surrounding the whole city. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Man's responsibility, his hard work. Our God will fight for us. God's sovereignty. There it is the fourth time. And so, verse 21, we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, let each man and his servants stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by day and working party by day, or by night and working party by day. And so neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off their clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. So thankfully they were bathing to stay clean during that period of time. But here's the amazing thing. Half of his labor force was in overwatch defensive positions, which is absolutely astounding because even with half of his labor force not being able to work on the construction, they still finished the wall in 52 days. What's that mean? That means if they had everybody, they would have finished it in a lot less time. It's hard for us to even comprehend that they would have finished the wall in less than 52 days if they would have been able to have all of the people. Nehemiah heard the threats of the enemy, but he also heard the cry of the people who were under his care. And he dealt with both of them with grace and with wisdom. And he didn't do so casually. He didn't say, God will take care of us in his sovereignty, and so we don't have to do anything. He didn't do so flippantly, saying, we've got everything under control and we don't need God. He said, we need God and we need to do the work. He trusted in God's sovereignty and he set the people to the task. And as a result of that, they finished it in record time. They were able to accomplish it completely. And in all of this, there's just so many encouraging words for us, because we are so challenged to be fearful in the face of the opposition of the enemy. And yet, as I've repeated several times, we've got to constantly remind ourselves that the enemy we are opposed by is not all-seeing, he is not all-powerful, he is not all-knowing. And when he is exposed by the light of God, he flees. When we draw near to God, he flees from us. And when we set ourselves to the task that God has called us to, he, in his sovereignty, makes us effectual. He makes us powerful. And he does things that we could not possibly do on our own, like building the wall in 52 days, which is absolutely astounding. And so these are all real good, striking encouragements to us, but challenges as well for us to trust in the Lord as we press forward in the work that he's called us to. Amen?